when you consider that he writes the work in 1863, he's towards the end of his life. And why write a mass? The only other great work of sacred literature that he wrote was a setting of the Stabat Mater, which of course is not particularly liturgical in nature. So why a mass? And when you factor in that it's a solemn mass, meaning that it is intended for a larger celebration, in this case, of course, it was written for the private chapel of a friend, for the dedication of a private chapel of a friend. In a way, it's kind of like the way Bach kind of compiles the B minor mass in his own life. It's kind of like a compendium of his entire art. At least that's what I've been reading into it. Because what's interesting is that there are so many different styles in the piece. You do get sort of these operatic arias. I mean, they're clearly very, very much influenced by theater music and the theater music that he was writing, especially for the soloists, the duets, the trios, and whatnot. But then there's a couple of other little interesting things. The Christe eleison, which is the middle section of the Kyrie, the choir suddenly drops in four parts a cappella, and he suddenly writes in the style of Palestrina, just out of the blue.
What do you mean?
Well, it's imitative polyphony. It's very, very conservative. It sounds like 17th century music all of the sudden, which is very odd to suddenly find somebody writing in a style that was essentially gone for over 200 years in this work, unless he's trying to pay some kind of a tribute to his background and to show that he actually, hey, I can write in a strict Palestrinian kind of style. And then, of course, there's these two by far longest segments of the piece is the end of the Gloria and end of the Credo, where he really shows off that he can write brilliant fugues. And it's weird because the Credo ending is just the word amen for like 50 pages. So the text isn't so important, but what he's saying is, look, I can write a piece of music that really shows off my skill as a contrapuntal composer. So that he's really kind of showing everything of his skill sets that he has in his toolbox in this work. So it's kind of like a last testament, I think.
And now, this is rarely performed?
In Philly, yeah. The orchestration is interesting because the original was for two pianos, harmonium, which is a reed organ or parlor organ that's something like maybe your great-grandmother might have had in her house, you know, that has tread bellows. It almost sounds kind of like a giant accordion in some ways. But this is a very, very important instrument in the 19th century. There was practical, it was portable, and so smaller churches or chapels that couldn't house a big organ, this was a perfect instrument. So that was the instrumentation. And then he actually calls for 12 singers, as he actually says rather humorously, for all three sexes, when he means women, men, and castrati. It is interesting to note that he wrote it for women because women did not sing in church. And he actually tried to make an appeal so that the work could be performed in public churches. Private chapels were a different matter. But to have this work to be able to be performed by women, which he really wanted, because it was only boys and men and castrati, obviously, who were permitted to sing in church services in the 19th century.
So why do you think he did that? Was he an advocate of women's rights? And
I think Rossini was probably about as religious as most artists were in the 19th century. Probably believed that there was some kind of creator being, but I don't think he was particularly religious. And certainly the lack of church music in his output, I think, would probably demonstrate that. He was a theater composer. He, in fact, in the inscription, he said his sort of own humorous prayer to God, where he says, you know, Lord knows you created me to write for the theater. And he says, a little heart and a little science, that's all. You know, did I write sacred music, musique sacrée, or just damned music, or damnable music, which is a French pun? You know, that is for you to decide. Have mercy on my soul, is that how he says at the end.
Well, maybe if it was his masterwork, which incorporated all the things he had learned during his life, he also wanted to do something new that would make people sit up and take notice, and maybe having women in it was just part of that, pushing the envelope.
Well, I think definitely the solo parts in particularly would not have been suitable for boy soloists. Now, you have to remember, too, that boys' voices broke much, much later. I mean, 16, 17. Of course, that continuation could happen, you know, with the castrati. But even by that point, they were starting to die out. And finding good castrato singers was frowned upon, even in church circles. They started to think, you know, maybe this isn't the best idea of ruining a young man's life. I think the fact is that it was written for a private chapel, and in a private chapel where the person has essentially a chaplain who will come in and say Mass for a wealthy family, they have much more license and latitude in terms of what they can permit in their own home.
Well, and maybe if he was this esteemed, celebrated operatic composer and he had taken time off, and was he aware, do you think, of his own legacy?
Oh, he was highly celebrated. He regularly had salons where the greatest artists and musicians and authors, etc., would gather, I mean, for his apparently notoriously lavish parties. You know, he was a rather corpulent person, and he loved to eat, and I think he loved to celebrate life. And in his little salons, he was having constant little musicales, and he would write little trinkets and trifles, little melodies and little piano pieces the end of his life, but obviously nothing really major until the Petite Messe Solennelle comes along.
So how did you discover it, and what drew you to this piece for choral arts?
Well, I was fascinated by this piece because I obviously have long given up on the operatic literature, and I'm very, very far removed in some ways from bel canto opera. But this work, I've known about it for years. I've heard sections of it, and I thought it was kind of interesting. But then, you know, choral arts is a 40-voice chamber chorus. And I keep trying to find works that appeal to my sensibilities of what questions come up for me. And when I thought about this odd piano harmonium thing, and I started to think about vocal performance practice in the early to mid-19th century, I started to think, I'm wondering if there is a research project where we can go deeper into the performance practice. And that was, of course, why I immediately thought to engage Julianne Baird, who, of course, is mostly known as a singer of 17th and 18th century music. But her knowledge, she's also a musicologist, so I knew that she would bring to the table a real knowledge of what the bel canto style was. And in fact, we did an interview with her, a video interview that's on YouTube, that you can see us talking about that very issue. And she talks about the various elements of what bel canto is from her research.
Could you describe what you mean by performance practice?
Right. It's also known as HIP, HIP, you know, historically informed performance practice. In the Rossini, we're using a 1902 Burzendorfer piano that is not constructed along the same lines as a modern concert grand Steinway, as it was essentially sort of codified more or less in the 1870s. The chamber-like nature, I think, is better suited for supporting the singers. It gives a greater transparency of sound. The soundboard is not as big, so it's a lighter, delicate sound, particularly in the middle registers, so that the singers don't have to fight with the piano. But the piano can just give a nice kind of pingy support to the singers, and they can sing as softly or as make a wild crescendo without having to fight the piano. That's one thing. Then, of course, there's the idea of going into what we call the primary sources. When we read either what the composers themselves or other performers of the time had to say specifically about the training of young musicians and what things they should be talking about in terms of vibrato, intonation, rubato, you know, and any number of subjects that help us in terms of understanding the interpretation of music. When you begin to play Mozart sonatas, for example, on a pianoforte, you realize that all of the things that a modern pianist fights to try to get the accents and the phrases, a lot of times they just sort of get played over, and the pianoforte, they just jump out of the instrument like, oh my goodness, it's the most natural thing in the world.
Can you describe what a harmonium is and what a pianoforte is?
Ah, yes. Well, Pianoforte is really a piano. However, the construction and the conception of the piano has changed, obviously, from the time of having a wooden framed piano of the late, mid to late 18th and early 19th century to then the invention of the metal frame, the trying to grow the tension, the cross strings of the modern Steinway, is all about giving a greater, fuller sound, which is perfect for Rachmaninoff. You wouldn't want anything less. But Mozart didn't know that piano. Beethoven didn't know that piano. Even Schumann, to a certain extent, didn't know that piano. Although this is a steel-framed piano that we're using, this Burzendorfer, it was really conceived for a small salon, or, you know, for properly for chamber music, and not meant to resonate in a 2,000-seat hall. So St. Mark's, which seats, you know, roughly about 450 people, that's going to be the perfect size instrument to really work with the singers. Now, the harmonium is also known as a reed organ or a pump organ. And it's something that you might find, you know, in your grandmother's parlor, you know, which you tread with your feet. And it has reeds, not unlike actually an accordion. So it has sort of a reedy tone to it and was often used as in smaller venues like chapels or parlors when having an actual pipe organ would be either too prohibitively expensive or, you know, take up too much room.
This piece, looking again how it fits within his old body of work,
mm-hmm.
people think they know Rossini because of their operas. How does this, will this change people's view of Rossini?
Well, I find that most people who know Rossini have, you know, some knowledge of this. Because in a way, it's kind of like, they say that Verdi's greatest opera was his Requiem. Bach's greatest piece of music was the B minor mass, which we know was never performed in its entirety in his lifetime. In some ways, I think that this piece actually summarizes Rossini's entire art. So you get these beautiful, lovely, soaring, natural melodies that you would know from his operas. But you also see somebody who has an absolute mastery of interesting harmonies. It's very, very, some parts are very, very chromatic and thorny. So you can see that he's already looking ahead and that he's been studying the music of his contemporaries, or shall we even say possibly the next generation. As I said also that, you know, you really find that he's saying, hey, look, I can also compose a fugue like the best of them. And so he's really putting forth, I think, everything that he knew compositionally into this work. And he spent a long time on it. Think about this. He would write sometimes four operas in a week. La Gazza Ladra, they know that I hope it was that opera. He was actually taken hostage by his publisher and by the opera manager, the impresario, to finish the overture the day of the first performance. I mean, that's like the kind of quick work that these guys were patching these works together. And so writing an opera in 2 weeks' time so that it can, you know, could go up was not uncommon. So he had a real sure technique to fall back on.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.